Thank you for joining us. I'm Nicole Forsman. I'd like to welcome you to session 291, titled The Religious Brain Project. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive and stop talking. Like now. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of our presenter. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. The session is being recorded. You will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you have not already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two in support of Mormon studies and scholars. This session is approximately 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the session to start on time. The brain is an amazing thing. It's a complex adaptive system that can at times adjust to the loss of a section of tissue through stroke or other adult onset trauma. In other situations, brain trauma can leave one incapacitated or uninhibited, such as with the loss of the frontal lobe, or perhaps with an English accent. Studies and research into the brain are also continuously investigating interesting phenomena on healthy brain tissue. For example, synesthesia is a condition in which patients sense things they wouldn't normally sense. Imagine seeing certain numbers or letters as colors, or hearing sounds and music as a colored sequence. Now consider your own experiences with spirituality and religion. What kinds of emotions, feelings, and senses did you experience? How fascinating would it be if one could find a way to capture and study and understand these spiritual phenomena and how they manifest in the brain? It is my pleasure to introduce you to someone who has been involved in a project doing just that. Dr. Michael Adam Ferguson, our distinguished keynote speaker, will present groundbreaking research on how the religious brain works. Using data from brain imaging scans, Ferguson will talk about what happens in the brain when praying, recalling spiritual experiences, or feeling a prompting. A Q&A session will follow. Michael Adam Ferguson is a research fellow for the Human Neuroscience Institute at Cornell University. His neuromedical research focuses on pattern analysis in the human brain. He is working to develop clinical markers for psychiatric diagnosis and care that will be based on direct imaging of the human brain. Dr. Ferguson was born and raised in Northern Virginia, where he attended a science and technology high school that put him on an early track to becoming a nerd. He completed his Bachelor's of Science in Biochemistry at Brigham Young University and his doctorate in bioengineering at the University of Utah, where he was a founding investigator for the Religious Brain Project, exploring the biology of personal religious ecstasy. He and his husband, J. Seth Anderson, were the first same-sex couple to be legally married by the state of Utah on December 20th, 2013. They are the proud parents of two pet rats, Amber and Bernadette. Without further ado.
Thank you for that kind introduction and for the warm welcome. I'm very, very excited to be speaking about these topics and in this context for a couple of reasons, one of which is because this is the context, more or less, in which these questions were first planted in my mind. I remember very vividly and very fondly in an early primary class, I think that it was CTRB, when we had the lesson on the resurrection. And the teaching tool that was used was to have a white glove on the hand. It could have been a different color glove, a multiracial glove. But anyway, it was a white glove, nonetheless. Maybe that's appropriate. But then we're talking about how during life, you have the body and you have the spirit inside of the body. And at death, you have the separation of the body from the spirit, and the spirit goes on living, the body becomes inanimate. And of course, at the resurrection, the two recombine and it becomes a living being again. And I just remember thinking, where is the spirit? That became the question. Where in this is the spirit? And it turns out that that's a question that's been asked by lots and lots of wonderful human beings before us. The topic this year is the Mormon mind. And it's a very rich and fertile topic because there are so many entry points to the discussion on mind. One is the playful imagining that all of us experience in childhood when we think, what is it like to be a chimpanzee, our closest genetic relative? We can talk about the anthropological journey. Excuse me for a sec while I turn this.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Okay. We can talk about anthropology, and we can talk about both the biological as well as the cultural distinctions that make us most human. Within the brain, within this biological substrate, over the trajectory of evolutionary history, there are mechanisms for nesting information, for abstract representations, for decoding and encoding stimulus that comes at us from the outside environments, as well as integrating, synthesizing, and creating abstract representations and chains of abstract representations to produce higher phenomena such as personal identities, things that we take so for granted that we create them almost as a hobby and a pastime in social media now. So how are human minds different from any other type of minds that exist? Again, a question that at some point each of us has pondered. We could talk about music, we could talk about language, and many people have and do. Mathematics, our capacities for logical reasoning, for abstract theories, for fiction, politics, and religion. Not only are each of the topics on this list fundamentally unique to human minds compared to other types of minds, but each of these companies has accompanying it deep-seated motivations that also can be understood through scientific and through empirical inquiries. Going through a very brief history of brain and mind, we might take it for granted, you know, that it seems to us that the seat of our identity, that our spirit, our soul, our mind is in our brain. That's a product of the culture and the assumptions that we've grown up within. In previous civilizations, it's often been thought that the mind has been located in the heart. The ancient Egyptians would actually liquefy the brain, and they would preserve the heart for mummification because they believed that that was the center point for the immortal soul. In Greece, you had conflicting thoughts historically. Some, like Aristotle, believing that the soul or the mind is located in the heart. Others, like Hippocrates, believing that it's located in the brain. Hippocrates, of course, was vindicated. It's interesting to note that within much of the Greek philosophy and argumentation surrounding mind, that the word psyche is used interchangeably with what we would translate as spirit. In fact, in Greek texts, this becomes an issue, especially translating into English for the New Testament. The roots of the word psychology are derived from the same word that, again, is alternately interpreted as spirit. This here is a depiction of Psyche with Cupid. Next, we have Galen. And he was in the Roman Empire and was a physician who really was very advanced for introducing the idea that we can approach the mind from a therapeutic point of view, and that the mind itself was non-differentiable from the body. In other words, that our functions of mind and our functions of body were one and the same. And so one of the very progressive ideas that Galen tried to introduce was that we could actually do some kind of positive intervention that would affect the body using the mind as the entry point, and a very early predecessor of mental health. Another must-see stop on this brief history of mind and brain is with René Descartes. René Descartes is notorious and famous both for championing dualism. So, in other words, René Descartes said that fundamentally, we need to differentiate between the functions of the body, which is the mortal part of the human experience, and then the soul, which is the immortal part. And he went so far as to say that that interface, that point of connection, where the immortal soul kind of uses this mortal body like a puppeteer using a puppet is in the pineal gland of the brain. I still don't know why the pineal gland. If someone does know, I would love to talk to you afterward. So I have some critiques of dualism, and they actually come from a philosophical angle. You have within queer theory this violent rejection of binaries of all types. It's probably most famously articulated by Judith Butler against gender binaries. I would assert to you that when it comes to these questions of brain, spirit, mind, that Joseph Smith himself could be categorized as a queerist here. We have in the Doctrine and Covenants a fairly radical framework where Joseph Smith says, okay, we're not going to negate either the spirit or the physical, but we're going to say that it's all one continuum, and that the things that are spiritual are of that same type as the things that are material, but they're just a more refined type or a more refined process of that substance of reality. A couple of other approaches that people have taken to understanding our interiority, the richness of the lived human experience. Carl Jung is a pretty popular thinker, especially in Salt Lake City. There's a robust Jung society that meets on a frequent basis. And Jung likes to look at the inner world of symbols as having inherent value. Jung was very fond of taking sacred texts, religion, and extracting and stripping down, okay, what are the universal metaphors that are recurrent here? And how can we look at these motifs as patterns that tell us something about the composition of the human mind and about human nature? There is some early work to link ideas from Jungian psychology with physical studies and empirical data from biology. Mapping Meaning by Jordan Peterson is one of those early explorations. In terms of recent history and modern approaches in this dialogue between brains and minds, one of the very vocal allies has been the Dalai Lama, who is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism. He's done several projects with scholars, including Richard Davidson, that's him with Richard Davidson on the screen right, to study meditation and the way that brain frequency patterns, as well as long-term states, have been affected in response to meditation and mindfulness interventions. There's another great scholar named Alan Wallace. He runs an institute called the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies. And he argues, both using the language of cognitive science as well as the language of spiritual disciplines, for embracing mind as a meeting point between these various dialogues of spirit, spiritual phenomena, spirituality, as well as mind, cognitive science, mental health. Other approaches to brain and mind are coming at a very fast pace from almost every institution that has a major research center. Very specifically, there's a lot of support for understanding brain and mind that's coming from the federal government, from the National Institutes of Health. They've launched a project called the Human Connectome Project, and it's going to be just as revolutionary as the Human Genome Project was. It's going to be just as fertile for scientific breakthroughs in the understanding of disease and how behavior and mind emerge from brain and biology, as was the Human Genome Project. So it's a very exciting time to be at this intersection of mind and brain. So I wanted to work with some colleagues here at the U and say, okay, we can take all these fabulous techniques that are being newly developed, and we can start applying them to look at religious processes in a way that has never been done before. What we're doing from this big picture perspective is exploring the relationships between the flickering of trillions of neurons in individual cells and understanding the ways that those relate to spirituality, to some of these most profound, meaningful experiences in people's lives. It's important as we're designing the framework for the study that philosophically, we could contextualize it in an agnostic framework where it didn't presuppose any type of, you know, theological assumptions, any type of assumptions with regard to metaphysical frameworks that people adapt, especially in the space of religious and spiritual dialogue, perhaps more so than they do at a physical sciences conference. But it's really, again, important that as we're approaching these topics, we do so with a sensitivity to the biases and to the charges that inherently are brought into these discussions. From a systems point of view, since my degree was actually in bioengineering, what I do is I take the ways that we think about mechanical systems and I try to map them onto biological or cognitive systems. And one of the basic principles is by saying, okay, let's differentiate between a top-down versus a bottom-up process. So examples of a top-down process will be the way that the mind influences brain. And this is something that's really fascinating in regard to neuroplasticity, that the way that we recruit our brains with our minds actually shapes the physical structures of our brains themselves and the wiring patterns of our brains. Another example would be the level of brain to body, that there are dynamics there that are a top-down system. Our motor control is a basic example. Bottom-up systems from brain to mind would be those particular networks that support our higher cognitive processes, those networks within the brain that end up creating what we quantify as intelligence, for example. And then body to brain, a basic example of that bottom-up system would be our sensory experiences. And these, of course, become key when we start talking about spiritual and religious phenomenology, since most often they bring the totality of the body and of the sensory experience in their peak. With religious systems that are beyond just the personal individual, we have similar dynamics where we can look at the top-down relationship that a person who is a believer has with the God that they worship. Also the relationship that's a top-down influence from the leaders of an organization to that individual has massive impacts on the cognition, decision-making behavior of the individual. And then in a healthy system, the bottom-up feedback also is in place, so you actually have a dynamic relationship between the two. I find lots of spiritual and spiritually rich meaning within biology. I think that at any point within the study of biology, that you're only a step away from looking at spirituality, since it's the study of life itself. I don't know that you can get more descriptive of spirituality, you know, in a broader single word than the study of life. One of the things that's very interesting is the metaphor that Jesus used when he was teaching Nicodemus, and he was giving him keys for spiritual discernment and with regard to the kingdom of God. And he said, you can look and see the leaves moving through the trees, and that those are what you can use to discern the wind. And so, you know, I kind of poetically look at what we're doing in the brain, and I say, okay, we can use the leaves as metaphors for the neurons, we can use the wind as metaphor for these motions and patterns of activity. And really what we're trying to do is we're chasing the spirit through the brain, if you will. And this is why this is so exciting to me. Like when I geek out in the math and in the pattern analysis and I get lost in the numbers, it's, you know, it comes back for me to kind of these bird's eye views. Up to this point, any clarifications? Because we're going to move on now to the experimentation itself. So with the Religious Brain Project, some of the basic goals were to determine the neural networks that are active during spiritual and religious feelings. Also to determine how religious practice affects the wiring of the social brain. As well, we want to explore the relationship between religious behavior and variations in brain activity patterns. Before anybody entered a scanner, we had 44 participants fill out 2 to 3 hours of questionnaires. This included various cognitive assessments, various personality assessments, cognitive styles, metrics of religiosity and religious motivation. There was a pretty intensive get-to-know-you survey, if you will. From that intake, we selected individuals who indicated high levels of religious practice and motivation. All of these individuals were returned missionaries. It was a roughly equal split of men and women. They were also indicated as being, you know, active, where they attended church services on a weekly basis, that they attended the temple twice a month, that they read the scriptures on a daily basis. So all of the standard, all the standard hallmarks for activity in the church. In the scanner, we had them go through a series of tasks to look at how their brains were responding during religious devotional practices. One of the tasks that we had them do was to read spiritual teachings. And we had spiritual teachings that were from both LDS and non-LDS sources. So imagine that they're in the MRI tube, that they're lying backward and they've got the screen in front of their face, and they also have a button box on their chest. And it's got four options where they can select how spiritually meaningful a particular quote was to them. Then we presented them with different spiritual teachings from either Desmond Tutu, Billy Graham, or Pope Francis to represent three out-group authority figures. We also presented spiritual teachings from Dieter Uchtdorf, from Thomas Monson, and from Jeffrey Holland. So here's the trick in the design, is that none of the teachings on those slides were from any of those people whose pictures that you saw. That each of those teachings came from the 13th apostle, C.S. Lewis. So what's your prediction? What would you think would be the behavioral patterns that we would see here?
They like their in-group.
Yeah, so people are saying they like the in-group, they like the leaders. And sure enough, and you know, it's not entirely surprising that even with all of the quotes being from the same source, being randomly associated with one of the particular source attributions, that there is a very clear distinction in the rating of the individual. We randomly associated to control for that. Well, but here's what's so interesting, though, is that when I'm looking at them, even with these quotes, even though I know that they're all C.S. Lewis, I can hear the person's voice who, you know, has the particular quote. So, like, here, it's like, when Christ died for you, he died for individually just as much as if you had been the only person in the world. So, and it, you know, it turns out that President Monson needs a little love here. He wasn't perceived as quite as spiritual as the Silver Fox or as Elder Holland. But with a very, very high degree of significance, there was this clear preferential bias that was reported through the means of how are you feeling right now? Are you feeling the Spirit? How strongly are you experiencing the Spirit? So real quick here to explain the differentiation of the left versus the right. On the left here, this was the question of how strongly are you feeling the Spirit? And on the right, it was the question of how spiritually meaningful is this quote to you? Part of my interest in parsing those apart is the interest in understanding the differences between affective versus cognitive aspects of religious experience and processes. Okay, look, yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yes. Can I explain the difference between the cognitive versus the affective? Sure. So when I say the cognitive components of religious experience, I mean, for example, your tendency to create attribution to a causal agent that is supernatural. So if you can't find your keys, you kneel down, you say, Heavenly Father, please help me find these keys. You look more and you find them. There's a process in your mind of attribution where you either say, oh, that was a confirmation bias because I kept looking for my keys. Or you say, that was a clear answer to a prayer. Praise be to God. That's a decision that your mind makes about the story of the events as you experience them. It's a cognitive process. By affective processes, I mean when you're sitting in general conference and you're listening to a talk and you start feeling that warm glow. That's an emotional process that triggers different releases of hormones that influence behavior, motivation, that kind of reset the baseline of your cognitive tendencies, if you will. And so that's what I say when I mean the differences between the cognitive versus the affective components of religious experience. Ooh, now we've got some hands, all right.
What's the scale from? Is it from 1 to 4?
This was just a 1 to 4 scale.
Well, that's an incredibly small gap. I mean, it's a great gap, but it's a small... I mean, Pope Francis gets a 2.3, and President Watson only gets a 2.4. Was that surprising that there was that little of a gap?
In that particular instance, there was. This is also the average across 60 different quotes that they're seeing. And so along that average difference, they're indicating fours and ones, and so there was a spread within the data, and this is just where that center point of the spread landed. Yeah?
Did any of the people that you're doing this on find it hard to rate their actual feeling of the spirit on a level basis? Like, cognitively, like, imagining myself in there thinking, I'm not sure quotes in general make me feel the spirit, but, like, different quotes... Did anybody have any problems saying, hey, I'm feeling it like generically across the board, or I'm not feeling it at all?
So the question is, did we have any challenges, more or less I'm paraphrasing, did we have any challenges with participants having religious experience elicited in the scanner? And the answer is, surprisingly, no. I was really, really worried that we would get through the first couple of participants and they'd say, sorry, this just wasn't ecologically valid, this just wasn't really doing it for me, I just couldn't get my spiritual juices flowing. One of the things that actually makes me encouraged to continue on this line of research is how much sensitivity there actually was, even in a controlled experimental environment, and how much responsiveness there was. A lot of the participants, so the question was, how did you find the participants? We had an article preceding the study that was published in the Deseret News, and a lot of people contacted us because they saw the Deseret News article. Yeah. Yes?
So, did you place the LDS authorities at the end of the study?
So when they saw these, were the LDS authorities always at the end?
So the question is, when they saw these, were the LDS authorities always at the end?
Or were they mixed up?
They were all mixed up, and they were randomized in different orders, and so they would be shuffled between seeing an LDS and then a non-LDS source attribution.
Did you show the pictures?
We did.
So... It says in-group authority bias. Could it have been some association bringing a past association when you see that picture of a... you bring past experiences into it because of the association with the photo?
Definitely. That's a great question. That certainly you're going to have a conditioned response based on your familiarity with the individual. And there's more that I'm going to say on this when we actually get into the brain itself. This is all part of the construct of in-group authority bias. So what you're asking is a very well-tuned question to say, okay, now that we see observationally that this authority bias exists, how can we understand that? And one of the questions is, okay, what are the roles that familiarity and association with familiarity and familiar faces play in this type of effect?
May I just suggest we don't ask any questions till he's done, because it would help, I think, all of us to just write down our questions so you can flow, you know, and we can get through it. Is that too rude of me?
No, we can do it how you want to do it.
They have to be scanned to see if that would work.
Yeah. But let's move on a little bit here, because I do want to get into the brain. Okay, so getting to this question about familiarity, each of the individuals, not surprisingly, reported greater familiarity with the LDS as opposed to the non-LDS religious leaders. Here we're looking at two areas that are involved in facial recognition and in emotional processing. It's a well-established phenomenon in the literature that when the brain sees a familiar face as opposed to an unfamiliar face, that it has heightened activity in fusiform facial recognition areas for the familiar face versus the unfamiliar face. So what's really interesting here, though, is that we had, during the presentation of quotes attributed to non-LDS leaders, higher activity in the fusiform face areas. That they were spending more time studying the faces, which, again, this is very interesting, because the opposite is the effect that we normally see, that it's a familiar face that stimulates more fusiform activity. Also, in the non-LDS compared to the LDS individuals, that you saw heightened activity in the amygdala. And the amygdala does many, many, many things. One of its prominent functions is risk assessment. Amygdala is where you can get fear response or anxiety responses. And so heightened activity in the amygdala isn't entirely surprising if there's a less familiar outgroup individual who you know to be in a position of power. Another finding is that you have higher activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So the prefrontal cortex is some of our newest real estate in the brain in terms of evolution. And it's what allows us to participate in critical thinking and abstract thought. And the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in particular is involved in some of these higher cognitive processes. And so what you have is a phenomenon at play here, where when an LDS return missionary is being presented with a face of one of the authority figures, that they actually decrease the activity of their dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. One of the dimensions that we examined in regard to personality of the individual was the tendency toward guilt. This was one of the assessments in that behavioral battery before they actually had their scan. And also in this task, when they're seeing the faces of a religious leader, that those who outside of the scan period score high for levels of personal intrinsic guilt have increased activity in their lateral orbitofrontal cortex when they're seeing the faces of one of their leaders. And the orbitofrontal cortex is, again, among other rich functions in the brain, is involved in the process of rule violation and social rule normativities. Other dimensions that we're looking at in the population are the moral foundations. Within moral psychology and moral theory, there's been some development and some popularity surrounding what's called the moral foundations. And the metaphor is used here of our taste palette. So all of us have, well, not all of us, but most of us probably have taste buds for salty, for sweet, for umami, for bitter. And the idea is that our moral sensibilities for disgust or for moral approval also have different flavors, if you will. And that some of those basic flavors include the axis of loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion, purity versus sanctity, fairness and justice, and harm and care. And famously, Jonathan Haidt, who is now at New York University, published a peer-reviewed article where he was looking at the ways that moral cognition could predict political liberals from political conservatives. And he wrote extensively about these findings in his book, The Righteous Mind. where he really examines thoughtfully what is it that's dividing otherwise good, decent, civil people along these fault lines of religion and politics. And so naturally, we wanted to incorporate these questions into our studies as well. I have to be, unfortunately, a little bit sensitive about how much I share. There's so much cool stuff that is in the peer review process right now, and there's just some sensitivity that before something is published in a journal, to not broadcast it too much. So stay tuned, because there's really, really cool stuff still coming out. Other experimental data that we have that we're going to be looking at is to explore what's called functional connectivity. And this is where this is what my dissertation was in right here, was developing new methods in functional connectivity. What this refers to is taking a map of the brain. I look at the cerebral cortex, the subcortex, as well as the cerebellum, which are three different tiered systems within the human brain. And I look at how closely related the fluctuations of activity are within those regions across a period of time. In a really good resting state functional connectivity study, you want to have, you know, at least 20 minutes, if not 30 or more, of the person lying in the scanner, just awake, not doing any particular task, and letting their mind spontaneously wander. And it turns out that how close different regions of the brain are talking with each other becomes indicative of a lot of things, from personality to, again, what we're going to be exploring with moral cognition. And so one of the basic questions that I'm going to be looking at is, how are brain activities related with one another during a prayer state? And how do those contrast with the spontaneous baseline of brain activities during a resting state? What is it unique that the brain is switching into during prayer, in contrast to when it's in a non-spiritually focused state of operation? Another series of experimental data that we have that we're writing about right now is with regard to neural response to religious media. We had the participants watch segments of General Conference videos, of Mormon messages, excerpts from LDS media such as Finding Faith in Christ. And then in real time, as they were watching the videos, with that button box that was on their chest, they were just asked to push the button every time that they were having a peak spiritual experience. And so we're going to be able to look in real time at what's happening when somebody is reporting that they're having a spiritual moment. So some follow-up here. It turns out that before and after spiritual religious practice, there's a difference in the way that the individual responds to the same tasks. In other words, that personal religious devotional practice does have short-term impacts on cognition, on affect, and on perception of in-group versus out-group assessments. Here we can see that after 45 minutes of praying, reading the Book of Mormon, watching Mormon media messages, that the differences between the in-group versus the out-group authority assessments shrink. That, in other words, that personal religious devotion, hold on one second here, and this is, okay, so this is for both the reports of how strongly they're feeling the Spirit, as well as the reports of how meaningful the spiritual teaching is to them. And in both cases, so look here, President Monson gets more love by the end of the study. After reading the Book of Mormon, praying, watching General Conference, that across the board that there's this increased generosity and appraisal of the source. It's fascinating because I think that it begs questions about the role that ritual can play in an individual's personal well-being. A big shout out to the Mormon Mental Health Association and to the fantastic work that they're doing to explore in depth how we can better speak in a clinical and in a healing setting the mother tongue of faith. Other upcoming brain imaging results are going to be looking again at these variations in-brain activity patterns with regard to moral functioning, and also in the resting state functional connectivity for markers of religiosity. Examples of next steps in the data would be to translate these questionnaires from English into Spanish, and then to begin distributing them amongst the Spanish-speaking LDS community. It would be a very important step toward doing a geocultural survey that looks at psychology from these dimensions of religious behavior and thought. One of the projects that I'll be developing during the next 2 years of my postdoctoral fellowship is a sacred text project that I'm very interested in mapping in a ridiculously close amount of detail what the brain's response is among groups of believers to the sacred texts that they engage in their personal devotional practices. Stories themselves have a very rich theoretical and historical context that also has links into biological and cultural anthropology. We have authors who are writing to the popular audiences about chains of ghosts, about the resonances in language, story in the brain, as well as the origin of stories and why we have a human craving and desire for fiction. It turns out that a brain network that has been recently discovered thanks to advanced imaging techniques is largely at play during storied participation. The default mode network is largely responsible for self-generated thought. So in contrast to externally driven thought from your sensory perceptions, from engagement with the outside environment, and our self-generated thought is definitely amped up anytime that we're participating in a religious or devotional practice that requires us, you know, by default, if you will, to separate from our direct, immediate physical perceptions into that transpersonal reality that's meaningful to the religious faithful. So with the Sacred Text Project, I'm especially interested in focusing on the New Testament and on the Quran, and having long periods of time over multiple sessions where believers from various segments of these faith traditions are reading the texts, and then we're tracing the real-time activity responses of their brain. And then afterward, we'll be able to go at the group level and look to see empirically, how is a Catholic interacting with the New Testament differently than a Latter-day Saint or than an evangelical? How is a group from a Shia population interacting with the Quran differently at the neural level than a population from the Sufi community, for example? Sacred texts and religion in general are probably not necessary to push too hard on this group as being important to the human experience and to human history. But truly, if you look at the swath of civilization and its arc, how much of it has been dictated by religious motivations? And so it only makes sense that we should start applying our best scientific tools to understanding these aspects of the human experience. This is kind of where my personal research direction is going. My project is going to be based in the cultureandbrain.org website, which is being built out right now. And again, this is my long-term agenda, to understand through these lenses of cognitive sciences and biological sciences differences across cultural experience. The future wish list for the Religious Brain Project team does include projects on atheist populations as well as Eastern religion in order to get a more comprehensive appreciation for spirituality in the brain. So a quick shout out that if you want to make it happen, there's a myriad number of ways that you could participate. In short, you can email us at religiousbrainproject@gmail.com if any of those ways speak to you. In summary, I would argue very fiercely that we're at a bright new dawn in the understanding of religious motivation and the impact of religious devotion. It's an exciting convergence of neuroscience and of cognitive science paradigms, propelling developments in the basic understanding as well as the treatment and intervention of human beings. And it's the potential to describe religious experience through lenses never before possible. If I could wax a little bit personal here as I'm wrapping up, I want to talk about my Mormon mind, and much of it was shaped during my adolescence. I think of the EFY soundtracks that I listened to on my way to high school, and especially the song, "What Miracles and Wonders Will I See as I Grow Old," would always just spark my spiritual imagination. And I really believe that we are seeing them, and that each of us are living them, and that they're only going to continue to expand. This ties in beautifully with a fiber of the Latter-day Saint faith, where we believe that God and Goddess will yet reveal many great and important things. I won't tell that story. Anyways, the richness of the Mormon folklore and the tradition of seer stones within early Mormon spiritual foundations totally gets me excited. I could geek out with anybody willingly for a long time after this. But I would say that for me, that the scanner and the computer have become my Urim and Thummim, that they become the way to see visibly that which was invisible, and to make sense and meaning out of what otherwise has been guesswork and confusion. And now, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
First, if everyone could please join me in thanking Dr. Bergson. Yeah.
I saw a slide. Evidence-based ritual?
Yeah.
What is that?
That is my extrapolation and hopeful projection of one of the ways that we could study personal religious devotional practices. So, for example, let's say that you have somebody, and huge disclaimer, I'm not a clinician. I talked with Natasha Helfer and Kevin Klusterman before this to make sure. I was like, okay, people in the clinical setting do use ritual, right? I'm not just a crazy researcher out of touch with clinical approaches. And they said that no, that is an approach that people use. I think that there's definitely a knee-jerk tendency to pathologize religious devotion and to, you know, ascribe it to, oh, it's all incessive compulsive disorder up and down. Or, you know, fill in your pathology of choice, right? And so I think that it's important to explicitly recognize and also understand the ways that personal religious devotion and personal ritual increases the meaning and the mental health of the individual.
You used three very well-liked LDS authorities. Did you consider using someone like Boyd K. Packer?
I did, you know what? And if, like, seriously, if someone, if, like, funding is a very sensitive topic all the time. I would love to do like a PR study on the sly where we're just like, okay, let's line up the apostles and like see who has the highest like spiritual meaning and spiritual attribution, and then be like, okay, let's talk about your image here. Like, how can we work with what we've got? Yes, so we did do a contrast where we took the male versus the female physiological patterns in response to the cues, and there were no significant differences between them. Here's the thing, though, is that this was a pilot study. As you increase your sample size, you can begin to parse out those more subtle variations that are real and meaningful, but that just require a higher sample size in your population to be able to really differentiate.
Because I think my own Mormon mind, moving from a position of sincere belief to a position of moving away from dualism, moving towards more physical understanding of the world around me.
Mm-hmm.
What neural pathways change when you stop looking at things mystically from a mystical standpoint or through myth and into a physical way of looking at it? Have you got any answers for that yet?
I do. Stay tuned.
So nothing now.
It's so, just, yeah.
Was this a cross-sectional design? And have you considered longitudinal studies?
We definitely want to do longitudinal studies. My colleague from my lab, Jared Nielsen, right now is doing his postdoctoral fellowship out at Harvard, and then he's going to be returning to Brigham Young University. And what he's specializing in is in-depth longitudinal analysis of small populations. So he and I are conspiring for the Sacred Text Project to incorporate longitudinal components. Yeah.
Regarding the pineal gland, that's where DMT is manufactured?
I don't know that. It could be, but I don't know.
But people that have taken DMT have had these religious, spiritual experiences. Or I don't know if that's...
What's happening there?
Yeah.
Here's the thing, is that that's an answerable question. It just takes someone willing to write a check to pay for scanners that can put 10 people through as they're having like what they think is death, you know, going through their brains. But those are questions that we can look at empirically. I don't know of research that's been done on DMT specifically, but you're thinking in exactly the right ways with how to use the tools that we have now to understand in fresh approaches experiences that are profoundly meaningful and altering for individuals.
What's DMT?
DMT is a molecule that is sometimes taken recreationally for simulating death. And people who have taken DMT will report that it, you know, helped them to process their own mortality, etc., etc. Jim Carrey is a celebrity advocate of DMT for personal spiritual expansion.
So if I understand the results that you presented, it sounds like if you start with a prayer, it kind of enhances your response to quotes from leaders. And it looks like your future goals are text-related. I'm always curious about how music affects our brain, and I wonder if you begin with a hymn, how that would have... do you have any...
That's a really great question. And when we were going through the experimental design, one of the considerations was that we should do a hymn period where we have the individuals bring in their favorite hymns or their favorite recordings of music. That was one of the ones that we had in the initial phases of design. And then again, unfortunately, you end up having to just consolidate all of your hopes and dreams for a study, and music hit the chopping block, because there is a really fantastic article that came out 2 years ago, maybe, in Science Magazine, that looks at the neural mechanisms that underpin music listening and reward responses in music.
Yep.
This was just music in general, which is a necessary platform, because then, and I think that, you know, you're thinking along the right lines here, you layer on religious music, you subtract out just the basic music response, and then you're left with what was uniquely impacting about the religious content of the music. Yeah.
Yeah, not so much a question, but just responding to the gentleman over there. I was going to come up to you afterward and say that there's a guy, Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, who's doing studies with DMT on people, and he's actually brought people into the hospitals and done all kinds of stuff. And as far as I know, it's the first real like psychedelic testing that's been happening since
Timothy Leary.
I don't know if you've heard of him or know who he is.
I haven't, but there are a few those strange ones of us who want to go into these nether regions of. And another study that is interesting, you know, on that topic of chemical enhancement of spiritual experience, if you look at the Johns Hopkins studies on psilocybin, which are more commonly referred to as magic mushrooms, that they report long-term, up to 6 months, increases in affect, in depression, lifting of anxiety, reducing. And you can just Google Johns, don't forget the S, Johns Hopkins, psilocybin, and you'll get a ton of hits on Google.
Experience would look like cross-culturally and in different spiritual traditions. To elaborate, do you think it would look similar at a neurological level, even if the qualitative experience is different?
That is a fantastic question. So the question is, what do I predict that we're going to see cross-culturally with regard to spiritual experiences? One of the things that I want to look at is religious practice that's pictorial in nature versus verbal and linguistic in nature. So in Eastern Christian Orthodoxy in particular, the narration of religious and sacred stories through icons and visual imagery is going to fundamentally pull in different brain networks than engaging with a text like the New Testament.
I'm just wondering if, if in this study, if you're looking at these individuals, if you differentiate between individuals who were raised with religion versus those who weren't, if there's something that happens developmentally to a mind raised with religion versus, say, a convert in adult life, that would make a significant difference in, how one would perceive from stimulus.
You guys are on fire with asking excellent questions here. It shows me that you're thinking like scientists. In this particular study, we did not have a variation between converts versus, born and raised LDS, because this population was definitely selected to be younger. We wanted, ideally, individuals who had returned from their missions as recently as possible for a number of reasons, that they were raised in the Mormon faith. But that, again, would be an excellent dimension to look at the difference between someone who is an adult convert versus someone who went through those developmental stages in a particular faith.
I'm trying to tease out how much of this has to do with the religious component. It seems that a viable study would be to repeat the process with secular leaders. I mean, the world is full of nationalism, a diplomatic leader whipping up his people into invading a country, fighting war. Star Spangled Banner brings people into national fervor. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of the components that you described would have their secular equivalent. I mean, many people in the room get inspired when they hear a quote from, John F. Kennedy, and contrast that with, say, Richard Nixon. I don't mean to pick on those two, but they may be examples of the polar difference there. So you made a comment earlier about removing the secular component. It would seem that would make a more complete study, and then compare the two and see the margin that could represent the spiritual component. Any comment on that?
Yep, definitely. Thank you for that comment. In particular, with respect to nationalism and emotions related to nationalism, there have been quality investigations that have looked at the hormone oxytocin, which is a molecule that's involved in social bonding on a lot of different levels. Between pair bonding, it's released during sex and orgasm. Between parent and child, it's released during childbirth and during nursing in mammals. Oxytocin turns out to also be the molecule that, or one of the molecules and hormones that's released for bonding of the individual to their group, to their tribe, identity and loyalty. So one of the hypotheses that I had was specifically that oxytocin, because of its involvement in nationalism and group loyalty and affiliation, would spike during the process of reading the Book of Mormon, seeing quotes from leaders, watching media produced by the church. And we did look at blood measurements. Actually, we have hormone levels before and after the scan on the individuals. As of yet, it turns out that oxytocin was not altered significantly before versus after the scan, which caused us to turn our attention on some other dimensions. But philosophically, what you're talking about is spiritual discernment. And this is the challenge of anybody who is theist, atheist, whatever. Crassly, it's our ability to correctly attribute our internal experiences with correspondent external realities.
Doctor, I have a theological statement as well as a question, and I'll try to frame it in a specific question. Many of us began our religious experience, in this dualism that our Western culture, of course, inherited. Flesh is bad, spirit's good, the world is basically bad, but my religious experience and righteousness may be okay, you know, with the right religious, you know, component and community of faith and doctrine or what have you. We can just go, you know, down the line. And we know the Hebraic model and the Semitic model, you know, was certainly much more like the Eastern model. It was one real creation, you know, where everything is sort of homogenized together in a realistic package that promotes reality. Now, as we grow and understand spiritual things and theology and spirituality on a lot deeper level, we see how these things are a lot more connected, you know, in the entire creation as we understand it. How, the more we integrate, how does this change the internal mapping of the brain as we change our view of reality?
There's a lot to respond to in that question. Okay, let's come back to the microphone here. Because I want to make sure I understand the question that you're asking here, but it's how can we understand...
As we basically move from a dualistic model to a holistic, singular view of reality, how would that change our mapping in the brain and how we view spirituality as well as reality itself?
Okay, so I want to answer your question a little obliquely here and say that it's a new era that we're moving into to have organizations on a global scale take an interest in the constructs and concepts of spirituality. And one of the first things is going to be to have a real strong consensus on vocabulary and phenomena and what we're talking about, and making sure that the experiences that we're pointing toward, the signified, have signifiers in common amongst all of us. And so I know it's not a satisfying answer to, like, how does our meaning of reality change, but we are getting to a place, and I'm optimistic that it's going to be a productive place where we can begin to have conversations across disciplines, both scientific and religious, using common vocabulary. Again, I'm not sure if that's, like, fully satisfying, but it's hopefully stepping toward your question.
Exactly, because as we develop the vocabulary and we can communicate similar interests and statements, that would bring us closer in understanding and able to identify our experiences rather than the in-house speech we now have from faith communities where we express similar things so differently.
Sure. And that's going to be another very fascinating finding, is to realize the likely heterogeneity or the likely differences among what we're experiencing and yet all using the same word to describe.
Exactly. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Perhaps I missed your acknowledgement slide. Did you find out the research on this scan?
So these scans came from a startup training grant from the advisor of the lab for the University of Utah. It's called the Brain Network Lab.
Hi. My question is, what do you see what do you envision some of the impacts of this study and others like it to be, to potentially, like, craft? I think it's particularly interesting that after people experienced spiritual feelings, then they rated everyone more highly. And so, I'm thinking about religion for atheists, like people who don't necessarily care, who just want to feel more love, who don't necessarily need it to come from a certain place.
I mean, sure.
Could this, like, what sort of, like, grand ideas could come from this research?
That's a great question. And these are the types of, like, very ethereal questions that I love to breathe. I think that it's been an interesting phenomenon in America following some of the Dalai Lama's cooperation in neural research, where you have communities that became open to meditative practices. You have yoga that, you know, is sweeping every town in America. And I think that people are becoming a lot more open-minded to crossing that literalist chasm and saying, okay, I can take this practice at a metaphorical face value level and derive a pro-social benefit, a self-soothing benefit, derive any number of positive effects toward personal flourishing. You know, just this is just one example that comes to mind is, you know, there's another Buddhist practice called the Green Tara practice, where Tara is one of the, you know, demigoddesses, and you sit and visualize Tara embodied and smiling on you and radiating blessings and love onto you. And I mean, I'll be darned if when I sit in Green Tara practice, I don't feel cascades of warm glow, and I just am more equipped to handle the world gracefully. And so I think that as we biologize and show what the effects and the physical outcomes are for some of these practices, that there's going to be just a natural openness to entertaining and exploring them, and people can find what works for them.
Maybe towards some of the future clinical applications.
Sure.
There's a number of studies looking at religiosity effects on health, mental and physical health, which show that intrinsic religiosity, which is God-centered, done out of love for Him and His ways, has very positive effects on health. But extrinsic religiosity, which is for rewards or avoiding punishment, so on, getting prestige, does not have beneficial effects on health. A fascinating study done at BYU looked at what's the mediating factor for the intrinsic religiosity effects. It turned out to be how much your religiosity engenders compassion within a person. And so I'm wondering if taking a look at all of this, if we're going to have it apply to clinical things, but I mean, those kind of details might be important.
And these are, again, you guys are all thinking in the terms that get me really, really excited and optimistic about the future of care. Here at the University of Utah, University Hospital has, it's a spiritual care team. And I think that, you know, that's pretty courageous in a lot of ways to say, you know, we're going to explicitly look for these integration points between systems of meaning for large numbers of people who are coming seeking care and those who are the primary care providers.
So, you mentioned the study that had been done on Tibetan monks. And I know that that's been used a lot to talk about the benefits of meditation. I was wondering if anybody's done comparative studies with other religions, or if you've compared your studies to see whether or not those changes in Tibetan monks, like meditative practices, are similar to those with other religious practices, or if they are unique to those meditative practices. Mm-hmm.
So that's a great question. It's about comparisons broadly between certain Eastern and certain Western approaches to spirituality, if I'm paraphrasing that okay. And we have done some preliminary analysis on data from long-term meditators. So these were Zen Roshis, individuals who had put in over 10,000 hours, some of them much more than 10,000 hours of personal meditation. And this is a funny thing with research and reporting in general, is that it's a lot harder to get negative results published than positive findings. And so I think it's interesting, but we found that there was not a solitary pattern, that there was not a convergence when you had these long-term meditators go into the scanner, that their brains, in fact, were not doing the same things when they were meditating. You know, there's lots of ways that we can interpret that. But it'll be interesting as we continue to study not just Latter-day Saints, but other Western practitioners of religion, whether that's similar as they seek these transcendent spiritual states, or if there's more of a patterned reproducibility across them. But those are great questions.
Thank everyone for coming out tonight. Before we go, though, we have a few final comments from Jim Murphy.
Thank you.
You can rest easy, as you've discovered by now in our plenary sessions. My final comments are very brief and have an ending that is very quick as well. I don't know about the rest of you, but just when I thought that I couldn't be more inspired, more educated, more enlightened by the sessions of the last 2.5 days, Michael appears on the scene and blows me away. Having survived the 60s, I'm here to tell you that there is life after that, and I could be an amazing test subject for you, having experienced the majority of the things you talked about, and experiencing more every day here at SunSoon. So thank you, Michael. Could you come up for just 1 second? We want to express our appreciation to you. Our supply of seer stones has been depleted, but we do have sunstones, and we'd like to present you with this as a token of our appreciation for your great work.
Thank you so much.
And Nicole, you always do this so well. Thank you so much for doing it, and we'd like you to have one of these sunstones as a memento of this experience, too. Well, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. So we'll see you in the morning. Thanks so much for being here.